Okay. Let's see what we have today. Wow, it's a big question. Okay. Some questions about immaterial jhanas. They are never called immaterial jhanas, not arupa jhana. That's only in the commentaries. They're called immaterial attainments. They're not called jhanas. Have a look. Number one, are they necessary for enlightenment? No. Are they praised by the Buddha? Yes. Can people attain immaterial jhanas with psychic powers but without attaining enlightenment? Yeah. Not fully enlightened. Well, usually, if they're unlucky, they'll get something. Did the Buddha's first two teachers attain immaterial jhanas? No. Now, the reason for that, especially the last one. So, if a person is liberated both ways, there are two types of arahat. Both ways, that is with the immaterial attainments, the arupa attainments, or with the jhanas, without the immaterials. So those are the two ways of enlightenment. Both need the jhanas, so says the Buddha. So are they praised by the Buddha? Yes. And psychic powers, one of the great psychic powers is called enlightenment. So that is a psychic power. But it's also the only psychic power which the Buddha praised, literally. So sometimes people say, oh, has Ajahn Brahm got psychic powers? You reckon I have? Okay, should I admit it? Because sometimes that at Ajahn Chah's cremation ceremony, it was on the Thai TV, I can understand Thai, and they asked all the people there, close disciples of Ajahn Chah, did you ever see Ajahn Chah doing the psychic power? And all the monks there said no, but the layperson said yes. And that was really, and everyone said, really? What did you see? He said, I saw Ajahn Chah teaching the Dhamma, which is the best of the psychic powers. And all the monks, oh, I wish we'd have said that. Because that was the only psychic power which the Buddha praised to express the Dhamma. So you can actually decide for yourself whether Ajahn Brahm's got psychic power in teaching the Dhamma. So the first two teachers, now that was the interesting question. It's been a controversy for some time because you know that after the Buddha, the Bodhisattva, the person to be the Buddha, was searching for a way to become enlightened. His actual goal was to end suffering, to find escape from rebirth and suffering. So that he did many ascetic practices, but one of the things he did was to go and see Alara Kalama and Uddaka Ramaputta, that's two of his first teachers. And so he went to see Alara Kalama first of all, and according to that, got into a state called Akinchanyayatana, which is of the state of nothingness, which corresponds to something which the Buddha said later as the third immaterial. And later on he found that had nothing to do with enlightenment, it wasn't conducive to enlightenment. So he left Alara Kalama and went to Uddaka Ramaputta, and that was a disciple of Uddaka Rama. He wasn't a disciple by himself, he wasn't a teacher by himself, but he was a teacher's disciple, Uddaka Rama, whoever that happened to be. But anyway, that he also, the Siddhartha Gautama, said that he had got to the stage of neither perception nor non-perception, which again has the same name as the fourth arupa. But that was not conducive to enlightenment, and so the Buddha just, tried many other things, including asceticism later on, and found that that was not conducive to enlightenment anyway. And this is in, because, you know, this is Majjhima 36, the Aryaparayasana Sutta, and this is where it gives the biography of the Buddha's enlightenment. So having done all of that, he just thought, maybe. He remembered the time, was sitting under the rose apple tree as a young boy, maybe 6 or 7, that he witnessed his father doing a ploughing ceremony. Now, to begin the little ceremony for getting the rains to come down so they could plant the fields and grow the important rice crop, which was, you know, their means of survival. So it was an important ceremony. And so because of that, that he was watching his father do a ceremony. And if any of you have ever watched ceremonies, they can be really boring. And so I was talking last night to a really nice guy, Ken Williams. He was used to be the moderator of the Uniting Church. You know, this function I went to, and we were calling, you know, that Abbot Placid, who was the old abbot, previous abbot of the Benedictine Monastery in New Norcia. And so, some time ago, we had the ordination of Kate Galsworthy as the first Anglican bishop in the world at St. George's Cathedral. So I was invited there together with Abbot Placid. I really thought it was Ken Williams, but it could have been somebody else. We were sitting, the three of us, the only non-Catholics, the only non-Anglicans, you know, in the sort of St. George's Cathedral, in what we called, you know, amongst ourselves, a heretics pew. So we're sitting there, and if you think an ordination of a monk or a nun is long, this was 2 hours. 2 hours we were sitting there for the first ordination of a Anglican bishop, and so after a while, because, you know, Abbot Placid and this, he was just, I known him very well, we're just both like little naughty boys sitting in church, because we're so bored we started telling jokes towards one another. We did, we had a great time. The thing is, they couldn't kick us out, you know, because we're 2 abbots and just, so, but they should have done. But anyway, just, it was a very boring ceremony. And boring ceremonies, you can imagine a six, seven-year-old boy, you know, just watching the stupid, well, it's quite a stupid ceremony, a very boring ceremony. And then just, you know, under a rose apple tree in the shade, sort of just went into the first jhana. I mentioned that many times people get these first jhanas, they don't know really what they're doing. For the, you know, the Buddha, that was because of his previous life under Kassapa the Buddha. He was a monk under Kassapa in his previous life. And so that there he was, and he got into this deep meditation. He never thought twice about it until coming to that point, that sort of brick wall, nothing was working. He said, well, maybe that first jhana experience was the way to enlightenment. And the insight arose, yes, that is the way to Bodhi, to enlightenment, the jhanas. Why was I afraid of that bliss of the first jhana? And so then he understood that the ascetic practice of not eating enough, not resting enough, just torturing his body was a big barrier. It's not easy to get to those jhanas when you are just so incredibly thin. and just really weak and unhealthy. But that's why he started to eat, to bathe, and just to look after his body, then sat under the Bodhi tree, and then got the jhanas and became our Buddha. Now, part of that story is, if those first two teachers, Alara Kalama, Uttaka Ramaputta, if they had achieved jhanas, then why did the Buddha have to go way back to he was a kid to start to remember his jhana experience? it's pretty obvious that he did not achieve or practice any of those four jhanas anywhere between the time he got them under the rose apple tree as a boy and the time he practiced those under the Bodhi tree as the Buddha to be. So it meant that those teachers, Halavakalama, Uttakalama, Puta, hadn't practiced the jhanas. And if you ask anybody who is not, it's not said specifically, it's implied, and it's actually just so obvious to people like myself that you cannot get the immaterial attainments without going through the jhanas, first of all. In fact, it's a very good thing to say, accurate thing to say, that the first, second, third, and fourth immaterial jhanas are a special case of the fourth, sorry, the immaterial attainments are a special case of the fourth jhana. The simile of the lotus, that's one of the reasons why I love that simile, because it shows actually where the next stage is. It's inside the one you're in now. Inside the first jhana, you'll find the second jhana, you go into it. Inside the second jhana, the third jhana opens up. Inside the third jhana, the fourth jhana happens. Inside the fourth jhana, because I was saying this morning, it's so still, things start to vanish. There you go, the first immaterial, that is so incredibly still, and things vanish from there. The second immaterial, the third, the fourth, and after the fourth, the cessation of perception and feeling. So these are one side or the other, so you cannot experience these immaterial things without going through the jhanas, first of all. Secondly, the Buddha actually said there, after going to those immaterial attainments with Alarakalama and Uttakalama Puta, or what was got the same name, said they weren't conducive to enlightenment, and elsewhere he says they are. So he's contradicting himself, something going on there. And as I understand it, and many people have agreed with me here, that what Alarakalama, Uttakalama, Puta were teaching were not the real thing. So they gave the name to it as neither perception or non-perception, that's the fourth, and the state of nothingness. That was the name they gave to it, but it wasn't the immaterial attainment, which is based on the fourth jhana, that the Buddha later was talking about. And if you want to actually understand how this works, I remember just getting a degree when I was went to Cambridge was quite tough. It's much easier these days. Standards always go down. And it's true, I'm not just boasting. Because I remember reading Goethe's Dr. Faustus, where it was in Frankfurt, in the university there, that they'd only give a PhD, once every 5 or 6, 7 years, just one. And so Dr. Faustus was awarded his PhD, and it was a huge celebration, in the city. Now, PhDs were really something special. But now, how many PhDs are just awarded in, say, UWA every year? Now, there was incredibly special in those days. So it's just nature. The standard always goes down. And even in my lifetime, you see what really is jhana. Just being able to, such a still mind, you can't hear, you can't smell, you can't see, taste, and touch. 5 senses are totally shut down. And, you can't think. There's no movement of the mind, which goes into verbal. They say, that's just too tough. You monks are just, you just want to keep these things for yourself. You've got to make it more open for everybody. And it's lowering the standards. What two very senior teachers, Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstone, say jhana light, L-I-T-E, which is not jhana at all. And so because of that, you can see, even in my lifetime, the standards are going down. So people would say, I achieved jhanas. Sorry, no. People get really upset when I say that. So what they do, Ajahn Brahm is too too strict. So they go to other teachers and they find one who says, oh yeah, yeah, you've got jhana. Yes, I've got jhana now, because I go to the teachers with the lower standards. Just like you can go to, actually you don't need to go to university. You could actually go online and you can post, I think, was it $50 or $100, and you can get a degree from an American university by return of post. You know, people do that. I mean, sometimes they try to stop that sort of stuff, but you know, sometimes that you need to have things properly accredited. So that's actually just one of the reasons I think that Larakalama and Uttakalamaputta were teaching like immaterial light. Not the real thing. Otherwise, there'd be no reason why the Buddha had to go right back to the time he was a boy to remember those chants. The bliss. But that's the answer to that. What is the difference between a forest monk and city monk? Do they have the same rules? Thank you. There is Gurisana Sutta, which is in the Majjhima Nikaya. I don't know the number, you can read that up, Gurisani. It's about the forest monk. And interestingly, they say the forest monk should be more competent with the Abhivinaya and Abhidhamma than the city monk. It's one of the only places where the Abhidhamma is mentioned in the suttas by the Buddha. And a forest monk should be more competent in Abhidhamma than the city monk. But I thought Abhidhamma means a book. You've got to study a lot. How can a forest monk be studying a lot? And this is Abhivinaya, Dhammavinaya, what it means. This is a nice little snapshot in the time of the Buddha, the forest monks. The Abhidhamma did not mean the books. It meant the explanations, you know, of these things. So what, you know, I'm saying now is the Abhidhamma. Explaining, you know, what the jhanas are, the way into them. That's the deeper teachings. Now, sometimes people ask, can you give me a deep talk, you know, about non-self? That's Abhidhamma. What we now know is the Abhidhamma, the book that had nothing to do with the word in the time of the Buddha. And also Abhivinaya, what does that mean? More sense restraint, not just keeping the rules, but, you know, knowing where the rules are coming from, and even more restraint than is required by your rules. But that was originally Abhidhamma, Abhivinaya. And so the forest monk, they would actually, and the forest nuns, they would actually live with more simplicity, further away from the towns and the cities, so they would get less support. And in the old days, in Thailand, the forest monks, you know, I'd say when I first went, they hardly got any support at all. You had to make your own robes, you know, from white cloth and get the dye and, you know, from the jackfruit tree. Is really hard work. And, you know, made my own umbrella and my bowl stand out of, and learn how to use a lathe. And there's so much stuff there which you learned yourself, because it was very simple. And because it was so simple and so frugal, while the city monks, you know, had much more things. They didn't have to make a robe in the city, they just got ready-made robes. So what happened is all the people, they lost faith in the city monks, and they started bringing ready-made robes and nice food to the forest monks, thereby spoiling the forest monks. And that's what happens. So look, this is, you see this again and again and again. So please, and I'm saying this, and you know that, you know, that affects me. Do not over-support the monks in Bodhinyana and the nuns in Dharmasara, and in Santiya as well. Keep them a little bit on edge, a bit hungry, so they have to do some work. Otherwise, this is the problem. You get really good monks, good nuns, good monasteries, and people flock to them, which means, you know, never get any peace and quiet. You understand, is this what's going on there? So that's one of the reasons why in our tradition you don't give me money. You give it to the monastery to build stuff. But if they start building spas and they start building coffee shops, if they start building, what else can they start building? Luxury items. That was why it was in Penang, the very wonderful disciple up there, he gave me, saw me, I was having to, I used to write all the manuscripts out by hand and just signing books, so he gave me a nice pen to use. And, so I could sign easily. And that was great. It was one of the nicest pens I had. It was really smooth, and so I could sign things very easily, very quickly. And then when I got to Singapore, the disciples said, "What are you doing with a Mont Blanc pen? Apparently that's really expensive." I didn't know. I don't know these things. Someone gave it to me and it worked really nicely. But I didn't realize it was a status symbol. So I gave it up and got just this usual pen which kept on running out. Such is life. Oh, I remember another conference that... I remember this one. That at the conference, somebody asked the question, is it right, appropriate, that a Buddhist monk wears a Rolex watch? And the monk sitting next to me wasn't our tradition. His hand went under the table really fast. He'd been busted. Of course it's not appropriate that a monk wears a Rolex watch, although... You know that one of our monks has a watch marked Rolex, Ajahn Santuti. It was given to him from Vietnam, cost $5. It's a fake. So he's a very funny monk, very lovely monk. So you can I see your Rolex watch, please? And you get it out with a big laugh. So please don't spoil your monks and nuns. Look after them, their good health. But that's okay, looking after their health, making sure they've got, enough the places to stay, not too overworked and overburdened. That's a good thing to help them with. But, this is one of our problems when you get sort of a forest monk gets ruined by too much support. So anyway, that's the same rules. Of course they have the same rules, but they keep it for the forest monks and nuns, we become more experts in Abhidhamma and Abhivinaya. That doesn't mean the books. They came much later. Dwajan, can I have a one night stand with one of your bears and borrow a cushion back to room to meditate? Many thanks. Well, if you ask the bear, first of all, now, we do have a lady here, the coordinator, called Burr. But you can't have a one-night stand with her, because if you do, her husband will be very upset. But with these bears, we have something in Buddhism like consent by silence. So you ask the bear and say, "Bear, can I take you back to my room?" The bear is silent, so that's permission. And a cushion, of course, as long as you bring it back afterwards. Dear Ajahn Brahm, after meditation I feel so high, it's like I smoke some good... And it said SHIT, that's not what I use it, and weed. Is it alright to indulge in this high? Does it mean high is equal to, weed is equal to meditation? Contains reference to drugs, sorry for the language. If it is those illegal substances, although that sometimes marijuana is now being used for medical, for therapy, which has those uses, then of course, that's fine if it's for medicinal use. But if it is just for getting high, you're missing out on the high, which is a natural, pure high, which comes through meditation, which is far, far better. It's not illegal, and it enhances your senses rather than dulling your senses, which is one of the reasons now you cannot drink and drive, nor can you you take these drugs and drive, because if you do, your reaction time goes down, your awareness actually goes down. Feels good, but you're not aware. Which is one of the reasons why the Buddha said we don't take alcohol or drugs, because it lowers our mindfulness, reduces it. So that's the difference. One is really high mindfulness, that's meditation. The other one is happy, but sort of a bit drowsy, a bit out of it. I read somewhere in the sutras that a kind of dream, something dreamt of three men that were in hell for 60,000 years for seducing married women. Is that so too strong a bad karma? How about if it were married men seduced by women? I don't know where that is in the sutras. I've never met with that. Going to hell for 60,000 years for seducing married women. So anyway, I never read that. But I do know that there was this was when first time that you went over to visit Borobudur, and there was this wonderful little carving right at the very base, because that monument in Borobudur in Java, the lower part of it is supposed to be the hell realms, and then as you go up it represents, you know, the heavenly realms, until eventually the top, you know, enlightenment. But in the lower part, I remember just seeing and being reminded of a story of this man with this razor wheel cutting into his head. And the story behind that, you know, an old, I think, Dhammapada commentary story, was that there was a man who had, you know, pushed his mother and she'd fallen over and hurt herself. And when this man died, he went to this hell realm and he saw another man there with this razor wheel cutting into his head. If you think he had a migraine, I mean, this is, you know, just continues for a long time. And something you can't take aspirin or Panadol to actually get rid of it. And so this guy, having his head sort of tortured by this razor wheel, he said, I think it was actually 20,000 years or something. Say it was 20,000 years. And he said, oh, I've been enduring this for 20,000 years, and I was told that in 20,000 years' time another fellow will come who also did the same thing which I did, was really violent to my mother, and he will now have to take this razor wheel. And so the razor wheel flew from this first man, he was now free from the karmic punishment, and now flew into this new man's head. And he said, it was a rotten thing which I did, a blameworthy thing I did to do this to my mother, and it's just such unbearable pain, but out of compassion, knowing how much this hurts, the next two people who have to come, I will take their punishment for them. So I'll do 60,000 years. And at that, the razor wheel just blew apart. That one little bit of compassion was all that's needed, because if you are compassionate like that, you just can't be in hell. It's your mind state. And that's one of the reasons why I've often said, the doors of hell are always open. If you can forgive yourself and get a bit of kindness, compassion up, because your mind doesn't belong there anymore. You forgive, you let go. Now, those states, I don't know why it is, but people spend much more time looking at those murals and those carvings of people in hell than they do up in the heaven realms. But somehow or other, heaven realms are boring. That is why you go to these, I remember, Madame Tussauds, the Chamber of Horrors, and people flock in there. And I remember even some of the Wapapong monks were going to England, and they wanted to see a castle, so they went to Warwick Castle, and the first thing they did was going to see the torture chambers. Weird. What do people want to do that for? But you must admit, it's sort of, you know, it's sort of not exciting, but more interesting for many people. So anyway, that's why Blood and Guts on sort of movies is very popular. So anyway, that from that I realized that, you know, you make your heaven realms, you make your hell realms. So, what heaven realm do you want to be in? It's custom made. Whatever you like. There's, I know, just some of the Christian heavens which I was told about. You eat ambrosia. Breakfast, lunch and dinner. Nothing else. Ambrosia for breakfast, ambrosia for lunch. After 10,000 years of that, you get pretty fed up. So I thought you'd have much more like choice. Many restaurants. So you can have menus. So you can have fish and chips today. You can have noodles tomorrow. Dumplings the next day. Dim sum on Sundays. Whatever you like. Restaurants. So where would your heaven like to be? What would it be like? So you custom make your heaven. What you think you deserve. And you custom make your hells. What you fear you need to be punished. It's called guilt. People who have forgiveness, who can let go, never need to go to a hell realm, even an animal realm. When you've given up guilt, when you know real forgiveness, that's part of being a stream winner. The lower realms are no longer open for you. You never punish yourself for stuff. You acknowledge, you forgive, and let go. Stuff of someone who's seen the Dhamma. So anyway, 6,000 years for seducing married women. So, how many years does that make Donald Trump have to? Harvey Weinstein? Yeah, that's got some big trouble. How many years do you have to be in hell for scuffing up a cricket ball? No, it's just... Whatever. Anyway, is mindfulness and meditation different? If you mean by meditation stillness, you know, mindfulness, you know, is just what you have before stillness. You have to be aware, but also kind to get to stillness. Is the process of nimitta, so mindfulness isn't meditation. The Buddha never taught a one-fold path, he taught an eight-fold path. It's not just mindfulness, it's a whole eight-fold path. Because sometimes people say mindfulness is the only way, which means you don't need to keep precepts, you can just drink and take drugs and murder and steal, as long as you're mindful when you steal. Then it's all right. There's something very wrong about that. Is the process of nimittas jhanas the same with metta meditation? Yes. Is there any difference with jhana that one gets via meditation, metta meditation compared to the Tibetan meditation? No. If yes, can one easily get to the other? They already have jhana via one of the methods. Jhana is jhana is jhana is jhana. It's all the same. That's why I said that if you achieve a jhana, your jhana, no matter how you got there, exactly the same as the Buddha's jhana. Same mind. Wow, that's really cool. But the nimittas, they're different. Usually the jhana, the metta meditation nimittas are just really beautiful. Just, I don't know, golden, just really nice. So they're more oomph to them before you get into the jhanas. You get into the breathing meditation, it's still nice. More subtle, more peaceful, but you know, still pretty brilliant. So the way you get in there, we know the nice thing to do is to do both. Just look at your breath with loving kindness. So look at your breath, our breath. You know, you've come into my body, fed it oxygen for so many years. Your breath, you're just like my little teddy bear. Our breath. You name your teddy bear breath. And you're so kind to your teddy bear, your breath. Breathing in, breathing out. You're not going to force it. Thank you so much, breath, for looking after me. You breathe in and you have this loving kindness towards the breath. Ah. And you know, that's really powerful when you do that. So, okay, I can say this one. I've got to be careful not to sort of, I've got a line, I'm not supposed to sort of say any psychic stuff which happened or any powerful Uttaramanusa Dhamma like the jhanas. But I know, when I first was playing around with this, you know, when I was first experimenting with this, was over at the Safety Bay, you know, in one of the retreats over, the one of the weekend retreats. Really tired, you know, because busy working. I don't write that down, please. Otherwise I get into more trouble. So, just doing loving kindness with the breath. That is powerful. A little bit too powerful. Because I remember just in the middle of the... Yeah, I can get away with this. In the middle of the night, I woke up because I was dreaming of blissing out in jhanas. And that was the end of that sleep that night. Didn't mind, it was really good. One of the nicest nights sleep I've ever had. Or nicest nights not sleep, or whatever you call it. That was just the metta and the breath, it just made it so easy, so wonderful. Effortless. That's really good stuff. So, join them together. You can have metta on anything. Like... Oh, yeah. Many of you know this story, but it's absolutely true. It's amazing. That fellow over in Frankfurt. He was at Frankfurt University. That's why I remember it. He stayed here for a year. Went over to Frankfurt. And I grilled him on this. He said, this happened. It was no joke. And he said, first day at the university campus, he heard the ATM machine gurgle. That's what he said. It gurgled. I don't know what the sound really means, but it made a sound really unusual. And so he understood that, perceived that as the ATM machine welcoming him onto campus. It made a contact, it had a connection with it, a relationship with it. So every time he saw that ATM machine, he did his loving kindness meditation to the ATM machine. May you be happy and well, may you never run out of cash. May people not swear at you when they find they've got no credit left. You know, stuff like that. And he did that, you know, just maybe trained by me being a crazy, having fun with your meditation practice, but he did that. And he said, I don't know how long, but he was having his lunch on a bench close to the ATM, and he'd been there for 10 or 15 minutes. No one had been close to that ATM, and he heard the gurgling sound which he first heard the first day on campus. He heard it again. And he turned around to the machine and a 20 euro banknote came out. No one had been close to it and he didn't know what the heck's going on here. But he took the 20 euro note, he waved it in the air. Does this belong to anyone? No one claimed it, so he put it in his pocket and went away. That's the power of loving kindness. And that actually happened. So, loving kindness, interfering with machines. So, if ever you're short of cash, it is true, amazing. So, anyway, so that's if you do it on your breath, it's wonderful. My son, who is 8 years old, has cried a few times because he suddenly felt afraid of being dead. I've explained to him that everybody has to die. This is the law of nature, however, he could not accept this. He also told me he can train himself to be an arahat so he won't be born again. But he doesn't want that either. Any advice? Yeah, the advice is that great advice from one of the most prominent American philosophers. You know who I'm talking about, don't you? Snoopy. Who? he was... sometimes I don't get exactly right, but this is the meaning. He was discussing the deeper matters of life with Charlie Brown, who was about 8 years old, I don't know. And Charlie Brown said, you know, Snoopy, one day we must all die. That's what you said to your son. And Snoopy replied, yes, but most days we don't die. Which I think is very powerful. So tell your son, yeah, he was very afraid of being dead. But tell him most days he won't be dead. Try that, because it just changes your perception without, you know, just forgetting the fact that one day you will die. But most days you're not dead. Look at this. Now, how many? Oh, 66 years. Oh, 67. So, haven't died yet. Gonna have one day, but most days I won't die. Is that true? Yeah. Dear Ajahn, thank you for your teachings. This morning it was very profound, and I never looked at suffering as not wanting to be where you are. I have a question around earplugs. I'm quite sensitive to sound. Would you recommend recommend it during meditation? Now, I would recommend earplugs during meditation. I only don't recommend earplugs during my talk. But if you want earplugs, sometimes people, they say, what can we get for you? But, you know, this was somebody who really made a difference, because they had, I think they knew people who worked in the mines up in the north of Western Australia, and they had these earplugs, which you use up there because otherwise you damage your hearing. And these were specially made to fit the cavity in your ear. So they offered to get me these so that when I went over to, especially on the aircraft, I could meditate. You know, because the aircrafts are very noisy. And even go to sleep at night time. It's an overnight flight. I could never do that before. So what they do, they squeeze in some like silicone or something, wait for it to set, pull it out, and that's the mold for these high-tech earplugs. I remember, this is how much people know about Buddhism. When I sort of got these made, the person who made them for me knew I wasn't working in the mines, and so she said, now you can get some sleep next to your snoring wife. I said, I'm not married, I'm a monk. They didn't realize what I was using them for, but I went on the aircraft and put them in my ears, and they're so comfortable that I was meditating there, and I fell asleep because, you know, I was obviously just a bit tired. Meditating, I fell asleep, and then when I woke up, I went to the toilet, and then I thought, wow, this aircraft is so quiet. Because I didn't realize I had my earplugs in. That's how comfortable they were. And so on the aircraft, I always use them. They're really great. So, you get them from an audiologist. I think they're about $100 or something, but they're really worth it. So I recommend those. And if you really get fed up with me telling the same old stories over and over again, get your earplugs out. I won't mind. Dear Ajahn, will your Aussie retranslation of the Word of the Buddha eventually be released in book form? The future is uncertain, but it's okay to be hopey, right? Yes, of course it will one day. When you don't expect it. Soon. It is said that the three other Buddhas appeared in this world before our Gautama Buddha. How do you understand and place this with regards to the development of our civilization? Is it much, much earlier than the prehistoric times of dinosaurs, and all that civilization belonging to the Buddha's times existed and then withered away without ever signs of artifacts? Also, never have I ever read in Jataka stories or tales from those past Buddhas about high sophisticated technology such as the one used today, e.g. satellites, gravity, orbiting Earth space stations, etc. Also, how would Darwin's theory of human evolving from apes, e.g. our tailbone as proof, fit into this? Thanks. There are two types of evolution, the evolution of the body, the vehicles, and the evolution of the mind. So, you know, the mind goes from one body to another. So, as well as the physical receptacle of this stream of consciousness, which evolves, also we have our mind evolving, or sometimes devolving, going backwards. So when it comes to past civilizations, you know, I remember going to New Delhi, the museum there, as a monk, you know, trying to find the relics of the Buddha. There's the best relics in the whole world. They're on show, you can see them, you can worship them. And these were the ones, the story behind them, these are the most, they were the Kapalawatu relics. All the other places, you know, were were raided by Emperor Asoka and distributed all over the place. But he could not find the Kapalawatu relics because the city had been destroyed after the passing away of the Buddha. And so, you know, these people, they look for these things, and the English guy looked at it first of all and found something in this site, but, you know, the inscription on the outside he misread. He wasn't a Pali expert. And it was on the casket, his name was Pepe. And in this, these relics have been left in the stupa with the Buddha's relics. And they misread that as this stupa, lie in the stupa. These are the relics of the Buddha. So they got it wrong. And the real relics were found just about a foot or 2 foot underneath by one of the Indian archaeologists, I think Saravasti or something. But anyway, so he found them, and they were older, the casket, and almost certainly the Kapalawatu relics, which were divided after the Buddha's, after the cremation of the Buddha in Kusinara. And they actually look like relics, pieces of bone. And they're there in the National Museum in New Delhi. Just, you can go and see them. They're not, please excuse me, they're not guarded by monks. They're not sort of encased, you know, in stupas. No one can actually look at them. And they look real. So those are incredible. But also in there, they have the relics of the Mohenjo-daro and Harappa civilizations, which were pre-Babylon. And sometimes Western culture just is, please excuse me, but it's arrogant, thinking that, you know, we, the Western world, discovered everything. And, you know, things like even the ancient civilization in Syria, it was not the cradle of civilization, it was a huge civilization in Indus Valley at the time. That was Harappa and Mohenjo-daro. And I remember looking at these things in the museum, and this fellow came up and said, "Oh, you're interested in archaeology?" And I said, "No, not really. I'm a Buddhist monk, but look at these ancient sort of stuff over here. And this, you know, just these are obviously, it's very clear. It's, you know, it's pre-Babylon." He said, "Yes, you know, I'm the head of the department. Come in for a cup of tea." And he gave me this really nice cup of tea because he really liked me, because I was actually acknowledging his work, and no one else did. So anyway, the civilization, Buddha's times, if you look at the clock of civilizations, how long ago was dinosaurs? I don't know my days, but I remember looking at this, plenty of time there, you know, of human beings. We have many, many civilizations come and go, and there are relics of those civilizations, like Harappa and Mohenjo-daro on the Indus Valley. And interesting about those civilizations was that those cities were in a grid pattern like New York. Just roads crisscrossing one another. And they say this was obviously organized. Not like the villages like in London, where the road goes this way and that way. And it was like organized, which always is a sign of a developed sort of city. You know, they had running water, sewage. So it was all there. And so sometimes the arrogance of the West, we think that we know everything, and have a look at those civilizations, there's lots of other stuff which begs the question, what was going on there at the time? For Friday, last day, can we do evening guided meditation? I can't wake up in the morning. Go to sleep here, and we'll wake you up. How can I convince my partner to come to 9 days retreat? So easy. Just to go back with a beautiful smile. So what do you do over there? I'm not telling you. Let's see what he does. This morning you talked about four types of giving. Chaga, empty, empty, empty. Mine only are the three. Thank you. Four types of not giving, four types of letting go. Chagra is giving up, expecting nothing back in return. Number two is Patinisaga, throwing things away. Number three is freedom, Muti, just happy to be here. So you're free. You don't need to be out there just wandering all over the place, as long as wherever you happen to be. Yeah, one of the... Okay. There was this monk who was supposed to be the Sangharaja of Thailand. Was it Thep Sidi Muni? I remember reading his book. Really nice monk. He was just a great meditator, just really simple. But then somebody wanted to be the head monk instead of him, and so set him up and accused him of being a communist. And look, if you get everything I said, cut a bit here, cut a bit there, you can actually prove I'm anything. And that's what they did to this poor monk, and so he was convicted of being a communist, went to jail for 2 years. Eventually they found out he'd done nothing wrong, it was a set-up. But he was so happy being in jail. And he wrote this wonderful book. At last he had a time to catch up on his rest and his reading, and to meditate. He didn't have to do all his duties. It was like a retreat for 2 years. And he actually said that, and really the way... He had to wear, couldn't wear his brown clothes, he wear white clothes, but he kept his monk's precepts all the time. And just had a nice, peaceful time. And then eventually, when they found out who he'd been set up, they released him, asked forgiveness, and said, doesn't matter. Had a nice time. So he wrote a little book about that, and just said, that's really inspiring. So anyway, that's... freedom. And the last one, I didn't mention the last one, is Anālaya. And that means nothing sticks to you. That is like the simile of another lotus simile. If you have a lotus and somebody urinates on the lotus, really stinky urine, and then what happens? The urine just flows off the lotus leaf because nothing sticks to it. Or then somebody pours Chanel No. 5 over the lotus. And that all falls off as well. Still smells like a lotus after you pour expensive perfume over it. Because nothing sticks to it. That's Anālaya. Non-stick. So someone calls you the worst, most stupidest monk in the whole world. Monks shouldn't tell jokes. And then they criticize you, and it all falls off, just like urine off a lotus leaf. Or someone says, you are the best monk in the world. Oh, we're so happy to have a monk like you here in Perth. And it all just falls off you, like pouring Chanel No. 5 over a lotus. Praise and blame don't stick. That's called Anālaya. Nothing sticks to you. So that's the last one. Last night a question slipped through the cracks. Yes. How the practice of mindfulness meditation is affected by that time of the month. Oh, that slipped through. That time of the month. It isn't. No pain equals no problem. Just like you, I guess. But perhaps you might reiterate your teachings on meditating with pain or discomfort. Yeah, when you meditate with pain or discomfort or... in some traditions, if a woman is menstruating, they're not supposed to go into a temple, which is absolutely, again, unadulterated gomayan. Of course you can come into a temple, because most of those temples are looked after by nuns anyway. Nuns are women, they must be menstruating for every now and again. So there's no problem there at all. So that's just this old fears and stuff which have no place. So anyway... But if you have some pain or some aches in your meditation, if you can do something about it, just like moving your legs, getting a nice cushion, doing some yoga to stretch the back, or going sitting on a chair or whatever, or laying down on your bed if you feel very painful, look after your body as much as you can, first of all. Number two is actually learn how to relax the body, not just by movement, but I said in the first talks here, just... you feel the pain, you just relax it, open it up, So that means that just like the story of me with the food poisoning, it just opens it up, and just after a while, just you don't feel any aches and pains there at all. Back to normal again. Really what you can do. But there are some pains which you can't overcome by movement or by just doing this mindfulness and relaxation technique. Those pains, you befriend them. Welcome, monster, into my palace. Thank you for visiting me. And then you find they no problem anymore. Okay, you can't explain in detail about the five hindrances and Can you kindly explain in detail about five hindrances and how to overcome them? And also right view and how to balance the five faculties in the meditation. That's an old talk, not a question. But what I will say, how to balance the five faculties in meditation, that idea, again, is Gomayang. You never said to balance the five faculties in meditation. That I don't think that comes from the commentaries, not ever said by the Buddha. Those five faculties are, what is it, virya, yeah, energy. The faith, energy, mindfulness, effort and wisdom. Samadhi and stillness. Stillness, yeah. Not samadhi, stillness. So sometimes people say, oh, well, mindfulness is in the middle, and so you've got to balance faith with wisdom, that's right, and effort with stillness, or energy with stillness. That doesn't make any sense to me, because the more energy you have, the easier it is to be still. Stillness is a high energy state. You get into a jhana, and afterwards you've got so much energy. So it's not balancing these things. And it's the same with faith and wisdom. You can't have as much faith, have much wisdom. So you're really, really wise. You know, come on, lower your wisdom so you can have a bit more faith. Doesn't make any sense to me. So that idea, those five faculties, they all can be as high as you want. You don't need to balance them, just increase all of them. And anyway, right view. My goodness. Okay, right view is agreeing with me, wrong view is arguing with me. Is that right? That is why we have the they call it the monastic rules next door for all the monks. I think I recommend this Jitendriya for the monastic rules at Santi. The abbot's always right, that's rule number one. And number two, if you think the abbot's wrong, go back to rule number one. It's called the Kim Jong-un School of Management. And actually, somebody, what was that quote we had today? I forget who said this, it's really gross, but you know, the way to greatness is destroying all the people who disagree with you. That's what happens with many dictators. So anyway, but right view is Four Noble Truths. A non-self. What else is there? No will. Will is a problem. Dependent origination. But that's a huge... And explaining in detail, but everyone thinks they have right view. The only time you can have really trust your view as right view is when the five hindrances are totally gone. How do you overcome the five hindrances? Nalakapana Sutta. The only way you can overcome the five hindrances so they do not invade your mind and remain is jhana. So says the Buddha in Nalakapana Sutta. That's it, Ajahn, I give up. Going nowhere fast. The tortoise. Excellent. So how much are you going to give up? Please tell the treasurer your bank details, your passwords, and give up. No, we don't do things like that. Anyway, great, give up. And then you, what was that? That executive who came along and said, this is where I am in life, this is where I want to be. It's just so much suffering, so much tension. I know I can get up here, but it's just so hard. And my life is just so much tension. Here I am, and I'm trying to get up to here. Said, how can I actually solve my problem so easily? Put yourself down to where you are. So lower your expectations to what's happening now. And then you're satisfied, you're happy. So what you want is what you have. Then you're free. So easy. But you don't get nowhere. You're getting peace. Isn't that what you weren't supposed to get? But now I've got to get something. Which is one of the reasons why one of my favorite quotes, which I saw on a t-shirt, nobody is perfect. You've heard that one before. Nobody is perfect. Second line, I am a nobody. Third line, therefore I'm perfect. That's logic. Really cool. So be a nobody, and then you're automatically perfect. Non-self, a nobody. Then you're perfect. That's why at the end of the retreat, please, I ban this. No, don't take any selfies. Selfies are not allowed. Weefies, yeah, but no selfies. That's like in the retreat center. There's two lines on the buffet. Do you have two lines on the buffet here at lunchtime, or just one line? You have two lines. Okay, one line is self-service. That's for the ordinary Putuchanas, and the other line is no self-service. That's for the enlightened ones. It's great having seen all these cartoons now for, you know. Have we still got that cartoon out there, I Want Happiness cartoon? Is that good? On the board, yeah. That's a really good cartoon. The guy, I Want Happiness. Number one, I. Scrub that out. Number two, want. Scrub that out. And what's left? Happiness, yeah, so easy. So, renounce all this I business. Renounce all this wanting business. And what are you left with? Happiness. If we think we are letting go and not controlling our thoughts, but somehow we are in our subconscious, how do we stop this? You're not in your subconscious. You're nowhere. What do you mean you're in your subconscious? So just let go. Keep it simple. Just let go. Be a nobody. Be a nobody going nowhere. Oh, what bliss. Could you tell us about the Buddha's title, Tathagata? I can go and can't make jokes about the Buddha. Tathagata is just a way of calling himself. But what is a Tathagata? Who is a Tathagata? So, somebody once, when they were asked, what happens to a Tathagata when they pass away, parinibbana? They said, what do you mean? What is a Tathagata? Is a Tathagata the body? Oh, not the Buddha. It's an old body. People even didn't know sometimes they saw the Buddha's body, they thought it was somebody else. What about, is it the experience, Vedana? No. Experience comes and goes. Is it the perception? No. Is it the will, which is the main part of the sankharas? No. Is it the six consciousnesses? Vijnana. I never call it consciousness, consciousnesses. Six of them. All different. You call it the fifth kanda as being consciousness, and people just really lose it. They're losing the Dhamma. There's six different types of consciousness. That's how it's defined. So call it consciousnesses, the fifth kanda, and then it really changes a lot of how you view the five kandas. And then, five components of existence. And afterwards, you say, well, which one is the Tathagata? And this monk who was being asked this question by Sariputta said, none of them are. He said, well, you can't even see the Tathagata now. So what are you saying about the Tathagata after he passes away? Ah, said the monk, Yamaka, I get it now. All it is just things arising, things passing away, that's all there is. That's what Tathagata is. Things arising, things passing away. Coming and going. Yajampa, my inner chatter is very noisy and doesn't stop. Please advise. Lobotomy. That'll stop the inner chatter. No? Okay. Inner chatter is very noisy and doesn't stop. Of course it stops. But do you notice it when it stops? Do you notice the space which happens once the sound stops before it starts again? The pauses between my words means you weren't chatting. Neither was I. It does stop. There it stopped again. See if you can notice the space. Just like when you come into this room, what do you notice when you come into this room? The people, the chairs, the teddy bears, the Buddha statue. What do you notice? Have you ever figured out there's more space in this room than there are things? So just change perception. Look at the spaces between people. Between the roof and the floor. Not the objects in this room, but the space between them. When you start to change your perception that way, you actually start to see spaces rather than things. The emptiness rather than the things which are inside the emptiness. Not just the thoughts, but the huge spaces between your thoughts. When you start to see that, then you easily notice you were not chattering for a long time. You never noticed it. That's very profound. Will you please give some information on Metta and Ajahn Chattrai's book, The Rule, not to send Metta to the opposite sex? I thought Metta was not love or lust, but more an agape. Loving kindness. Of course it is. Look, if you have lust towards a particular person, of the opposite sex, or the same sex, we can't be gender specific these days. So if it is somebody who gets, you lust or you want, or not even that, if it's loving kindness to, to the teddy bear, that's the teddy bear I want. I can't really do that. But anyway, if it's to a being and you really, really want it, then of course loving kindness towards it can be so close, to lust. That was what Ajahn Chah told the first monks going to the West. He said, don't do too much loving kindness, otherwise you'll end up having babies. That's what he said. I don't know if I agree with that, but it was just typical Ajahn Chah. you give loving kindness to all beings because it's just wanting people to be happy and well. After a while, being a monk, you don't see a woman or a man, it's just a being, five khandhas. And sometimes these distinctions people make. Women are from Venus, men are from Mars. We're all from planet Earth. So, this is why human beings, I know that something which I noticed that when you're very young, it's really hard to say, your gender. Just boys and girls, you look at them, if they didn't sort of have their particular hairstyle or their particular sort of type of clothing, until puberty, men and women are pretty much the same. Just looking at them. But then we get our puberty, and when we're trying to attract a partner in life, and then we really sort of change. We are different, physically. Then after a while, when you get to a certain age, your breasts sag, the hair gets grey like everybody else, and your distinguishing features start to disappear. So, what's the difference? It's only the difference which we make when we get It's only just for the sense of procreation, marriage and looking after kids. And then afterwards, men or women, sometimes, what's the difference? It's only just those few years. But still, people, making up their hair this way, what you're supposed to look like, and makeup and stuff. So anyway, I think that maybe that's putting too much. But to say we shouldn't have metta on sort of the opposite sex. No. Okay, because you're the opposite sex, I'll give you some metta. Ah, yeah.
You can say metta of being.
Yeah.
But you should not use the opposite gender as the object of the metta.
Ah, okay. So just not that particular aspect of the person. Just because they're a person, that's all.
Then metta is an object.
Yeah, okay.
Like meditation, breath is the object of meditation.
Yeah, yeah.
So don't use that person as your object meditation.
Okay. Very good. Very good. Okay. Done. Wow, lots of questions here. Is jhana the fourth or highest? I heard people mention jhana the fifth to the eighth. Fourth jhana is the place where you have the highest mindfulness, the strongest, the most powerful. The other ones, the mind is now disappearing, it's vanishing, stage by stage. The knower is going. Do Ajahn, please suggest what can be done as a thank you to Bianca. She is amazing. I will not be able to put up with this with such kind, listen, generous, anger-free mind for one day. So, the way to thank her is did she do this expecting thanks? No. Just the best way to thank her is on the last day, make sure you clean up your hearts. And you make sure everything is nice and clean. You don't leave anything dirty around. That's the best way. So sometimes people say to me, what's the best way to thank you, Ajahn Brahm, for all your teachings? I say, don't do this for thanks. All you need to do is just to pass these teachings on to somebody else. That's what Ajahn Chah told me. He said, if I have helped you at all, that it means I'm in debt. So if Bianca's helped you, you're in debt. You don't pay that back by giving something to her. You go and help somebody else. That way the gift of kindness goes on and on and on and on and on and on. So Ajahn Chah told me, don't thank Ajahn Chah for everything he gave you. My job is now to go and help somebody else. If I've helped you, your job is to go and help somebody else. It goes on and on and on, spreading the wheel. Or pushing the wheel of Dharma. It was a wonderful way to start the day with a little bit of your brilliant guided meditation. It made my day. Thanks, Ajahn Brahm. What did I do? Our last question. Our last. Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. Oh, did you answer them? Oh, okay. Very good. You said Ajahn. You're a teacher, Ajahn. Very great. Okay. Here we go. Very good. Dear Ajahn Brahm, with respect to you, the sound of the preliminary homage last night was like four beautiful songbirds. And all the jokes were brand new. Question, does this mean the end of suffering? Temporary end of suffering. Until you remember, wow. Somebody's been playing around and they made a... What is this one here? Dear Ajahn Brahm. My question is about humility and self-confidence. Sometimes I feel this can be a tricky balance, as too much humility makes me feel like a doormat, and overconfidence comes as arrogance. How do I make a healthy balance? Your insights are appreciated. Well, I'm a very humble monk, but I always say that if you are humble, you should let people know about it. Otherwise, what's the point? So if you have humility, please flaunt it. And so we can actually have a competition, the most humble monk or nun. So who was the most humble nun last night? It's that Guinness Book. If you're already humble, you should have a humble competition to get into the Olympic Games, gold medal humility. what was it? There's this joke, you know, in Christianity it's a lot of self-effacement, and there was this convent, and a new nun was sitting in her cell saying, I am just hopeless, I am terrible, I'm not really worthy to be a nun. And just, you know, I don't know why people make me as nun, just I'm just insignificant in the face of the great God or whatever. And then the abbess was going past and said, who does she think she is? She's only been a month for a couple of weeks. Because the more humble you are, I think you get it if you've exposed to Christianity. But anyway, and especially that type of Christianity. So humility and self-confidence. Self-confidence, you can be whoever you are. So you can be all sorts of people whenever you want to be. So you have no ego, no sense of self. So when it's the time to sit up there and serve, you serve. It's the time to be in your hut and to be a nobody, you're a nobody. So you can flip like a chameleon from one to the other because you've got no self. You can be whatever you want. Next question. Ooh, it's going to turn around. We have only seen Dana lunch donations are almost 100% given by Asians like Thai or Sri Lankans, etc. I have never seen my fourth retreat, 12 years of Dhamma Loka attended, or Caucasian donating Dana. What about Bianca? What about Ajahn Brahm and all the nuns here who are giving you the Dhamma Dana? Many types of Dana. So anyway, Caucasian donating Dana. Well, they do. Go over to Bodhinyana. Many Caucasians go. Anyway, what are you talking about? Because when I New Year's Eve, I asked some tricky questions for people. I said, how many Asian monks are there at Bodhinyana Monastery? Just percentage-wise. Now you were there, don't spoil it. 100% Asians. 100% Asians are monks and nuns are in Dhyana Grove right now. Of course, there's Malaysian, well, where's, oh there you are, sister go to me, Malaysian, Australasian, Caucasian, all Asians. So we've got 100% Asians population over in Bodhinyana Monastery. All Asians. So in other words, it's not really an issue. We have seen many Caucasians enjoy the benefits of your teaching and centers. Is this lack of common sense? Give back to whom they support. Lack of Dharma education to increase awareness about gratitude, Dharma giving back. Lack of childhood training in sharing. No, it's just whoever wishes to come. And look, There's something about my upbringing, because, you know, it was a poor neighborhood, and the school which I attended, a primary school, was full of migrants. I didn't know any better at the time. But there was Africans, East Asians, Sri Lankans, and just Indians. And it didn't really matter. Anyone who could play good soccer was in my team. Didn't care where they came from. So, yeah, you did get to be a bit of a colourblind when you were at school, because it was in a place with so many, an old Pakistani man, I remember him. What was his name? I forget now. Anyways, we'll come back to me soon. And yes, he was a nice mate. So, wonderful, you don't really worry about. Anyway, we all get mixed up these days. Sometimes I honestly don't know where I belong. I go back to England, that's where I was born, and go there and think, oh, it's like coming home, but it's changed. Then I go to Sri Lanka, and you get these nice people, they meet me at the airport and say, welcome home. And then I go to Thailand, I spent 9 years there, welcome home. And then I go to Indonesia, and Handika says, oh, welcome home, Ajahn Brahm. And then I go to Singapore, and they say, oh, welcome home, why can't you stay here longer? Then I go to Malaysia. And they say, welcome home. And then where else do I go? Oh, to Hong Kong. Welcome home. And this place, actually, they feel like home. My friends, people I care about and people who care about me. So I don't get, and then, oh, sorry, Then I come to Australia. And then coming home. So, you know, I don't know where my home is. You ever had that feeling? You've got sort of places you've been and spent a long time at. And, I know, this is probably the same with many Thai people tell me this. I'm sure it's the same with you, Ananda. You go over to Sri Lanka, you know, your hometown, and you miss Australia. And then you come back to Australia and you miss Sri Lanka. You know, just we're international people these days. So, anyway. So that's, no, I don't really see any problem there. So Ajahn, you always mention Samatha Vipassana is like inside and outside of your hand. Samatha, as I understand it, is calming of the mind by doing breath on walking meditation. Vipassana is observing the sensation of the body. Isn't this the same as body contemplation? Please explain. That is a little bit of misinformation, because Samatha Vipassana always go together. You can't just calm the mind by doing breath. The Vipassana, insight, calms the mind. Obvious, I've been telling you, when you let go of the past and future. Understand that, you know, you're out of control, so just let go. You need insight to know what letting go is. That's what calms the mind. Doing breath or walking meditation. Walking breath meditation, that's what the Buddha did under the Bodhi tree, and it led him to the full enlightenment. So, there's no difference there. So sometimes people do this, they separate these things out just, you know, to emphasize something which doesn't exist. There is no difference. And sometimes I do this, it's a little bit of a deceit, but I do it. Sometimes when people come, I teach them breath meditation to begin with. If they can't do breath meditation, I teach them Anapanasati. If they can't watch the breath, I'll teach you Anapanasati. And they can't do Anapanasati, so I teach them Satipatthana. And then when they find Satipatthana is difficult, I teach them Vipassana. When they can't do Vipassana, I teach them insight. When they can't do insight, I teach them Metta meditation. When they can't do Metta meditation, I teach them loving kindness. When they find loving kindness is difficult, then I teach them breath meditation. By that time, they don't know that's where they started from. And it's basically just exactly the same. Just like, because, you know, as a student, I got a job in the post office in Acton, where I was living, just helping with the Christmas post. And so one day, the post office guy, you know, was busy, so gave me the key for actually to open the post box, the main post box in the main post office. And there were three slots in the wall. One was international post, one was, you know, the country post outside of London, the other one was London, local post. So people were really careful to find out. Oh, this was international, they put it in that one. It was local, they put it in the one far right. The middle was like just, you know, countryside, UK. So when I opened it up, all those three slots fell into the same hole. It was really funny. I remember that. Just like, you know, you do samatha. This is a samatha retreat, so it goes in that hole. This is Vipassana retreat, this is Metta retreat, all goes in the same hole. So that is actually true. I always sleep a little bit during meditation. When I wake up, I feel hot, sweating for a while. Why? Oh, because it's good for your health. Hot, sweating means like a sauna, which is supposed to be really good for your health and space. So hot, sweat, it's good for you. I don't know why, but, you know, maybe because you're wearing too many blankets. That's why. Do Ajahn, can you explain what Ajahn Chah meant by when you cannot go forward, you cannot go backwards, and you cannot stand still, what can you do? You let go. In other words, you stop doing things. Going forward, no, you can't go forward. Going back, you can't go back. You can't stand still because you're doing standing still. So you give up, let go. The other option. Stop doing things. Standing still. Standing still is doing something. But when you can't stand it, don't do it. Nothing. Okay. The last question. A monk from the USA. He wants to move here to attend BSWA monk here. Please tell me how can he do to be approved? Does he have to directly talk with you or only email you? He's got to first of all get a hut built somewhere. So if he can actually build a hut in the United States, and if he can bring it with him when he comes here, then he can put a pre-built hut on the... There's no place to stay. So, you know, unfortunately, that this is a pop... You know how hard it is just to get into a meditation retreat here. Imagine how hard it is to get into the monkhood here. I'd love to ordain as many people as possible, but... You know, where do we put them? And that's a big problem with, you know, the council and council regulations. Because it's in a bushfire zone. So we have a choice. We can actually just clear all the trees from the forest. And then we can build as many huts as we want. But that doesn't make sense to me. So, please excuse me, it's an overreaction. In 1991... January the 31st, the hottest day ever recorded, hottest temperature ever recorded in around Perth, Western Australia, 46.3 or something. Later on, we had a day which was even hotter, but it still stands as the second hottest day ever recorded, when we had a big bushfire, crown fire right through Bodhinyana Marsh. I was there. The tree, boom, as they exploded. Really exciting. It was like a bomb going off. The reason is because when it gets very hot, all of the eucalypt oil in the leaves and in the bark of the tree evaporates in explosive mixture, oil and air and oxygen. And just need a spark and boom. So once the fire starts, it's really hard to stop the crown fire. It's amazing to see that. And no building was damaged. No building was damaged. There was smoke damage in one of the buildings, but nothing actually was damaged there. It's amazing. Because when I left, there was the, who was it? It was the fire officer came, and he was the one who panicked. He said, "Get out now." So we followed his orders, and as soon as we got to the evacuation point down at Southwest Highway, you know, the fellow who was the head just really rolled his eyes. You should never evacuate at the last, well, actually just when the fire was already just passing you. That's a long time, but we followed our orders. We had to. Fortunately, you know, we were calm and peaceful. And when, I remember just seeing the flames and the burning, which was up there on the top of the hill. And Ajahn Chakro, he was the abbot then, he was had some R&R. And when he came back, sort of he didn't know we'd all been evacuated, and he went to the bottom of the hill and said, "I've got to go up there." He said, "You can't. My monks are up there." He didn't know we'd been all evacuated. And he saw this big explosion of trees and said, "Do you really want to go up there?" And he said, "Okay, no." I mean, you know, this was no, it's like going into the being a bombing zone. So again, it was a wonderful little experience because, you know, we tried our very best. And then we went off to a shearing shed, you know, for the night just to get some rest. Didn't really get any rest. And I thought, as I was going back, the monastery was gone. But nothing can withstand that fire. And I thought, you know, all that hard work, you know, my two bad bricks in the wall, all that, because I did most of those buildings, it was all destroyed. But it was worth it. You know, you put all that effort in, doesn't matter, you lost it. It was really good. Then when we went up the next day, we saw all the, you know, it was in the morning time when we finally let go up there, we saw all of the corrugated iron roofs, like, shining in the early morning sunlight. Everything was intact. And then, this was amazing. That it was really dirty. And my goodness, you know, there's so much smoke around, but you've got some photographs of, you know, the devastation which the fire with all the trees. And you could actually see right through the forest, see all, maybe all the huts, because there was nothing screening one hut from the other. All the trees were just black and there's no green anywhere. And just, you know, we were working, just as from early morning to we couldn't sleep. Waste of time having a shower, because as soon as you showered, you know, you cleaned out your hut, but the dust was, the charcoal was in the air all the time. It took days for the charcoal to settle, you know, and the, and you could actually just, it was worthwhile taking a wash. It was just in just soot, you know, for days on end. And the kangaroos, you know, that they had nothing to eat. So we got, went to Armidale, to the local grocer, and we told what happened. I saw it in the news. So he gave us a big bag of carrots and apples. So we fed those kangaroos for the first few days until some more grass came up. And that's actually, you know, why they always come to us, is they notice we look after them, they look after us. So I think that's where that, so we really got to know the wildlife. Looked after them, that didn't have anything to eat. And all those huts, nothing was damaged. There was smoke damage in the room which I'm in now, my office. But everything else was fine. And I remember just going with the head of the bushfires in Perth. He came out to have an investigate. I remember going around one of the A-frames, which we still have. I went around it with him. He was looking at it and looking at it. I remember he turned around to me. I always remember this. He said, "Brahm, this should not be here." But it was. And that was such a big... So we know what it's like. You know, we've been in it, and all our huts survived. We know how to build bushfire resistant, but it doesn't fulfill the codes. So no one is willing to take a chance. So because of that, all this stuff which we have to do, which is almost impossible, we're trying our best. That's a difficulty right now. You know, just, there's plenty of support. It's not we need to raise funds to build huts. We just need to, how the heck can we do this? To get the overreaction, and there is an overreaction, you know, for the bushfire danger, to actually just for people to take responsibility. And I know we've got a really good system here. We've got actually a FISA, that's Fire Emergency Services Award. Cheryl Edwards, I think, she came here to offer the award because of our bushfire protection. So we've got all the stuff there, but still it's hard to do. That's one of the reasons why, you know, just we can't have any more monks at the moment. What can you do? You have to have a place for them to stay. And some monks come and say, "Oh, it doesn't matter. I can just sleep in a tent under a tree." Yes, you can. But as soon as the Shire Health and Safety come and have a look, you know, they'll say, "No, get out of here and find the Buddhist Society." Of course, you can't do that. So, you know, it's really difficult. But anyway, see what happens. To answer the question, sort of anyway, it's very exciting. Because after the fire, I was interviewed, Channel 7 or Channel 9, after the fire. As I said, you know, "Ajahn Brahm, what happened? Were you scared? Were you afraid for your life?" "Oh, no, you know, it just comes and goes." And I was so cool about it. But the lady later on just got really sort of interested in Buddhism. Because, you know, being a reporter, many, many times people had these big accidents, they saw this and they saw that, and they were really upset about it. And they weren't. So I mean, she contacted me later on. And then there was the time when I think it was Curtin University, they sent the psychology students out to give us a questionnaire about whether they had flashbacks, whether they were traumatized, whether they needed, you know, some sort of counseling. I said, no, it's fine. And they never came back again. They never published the report because it was hopeless. You know, really disappointed them, you know, where you should have had trauma, you weren't. So that didn't really fit in. So they just canned that one. They don't have flashbacks, it's just you let it go. So this actually, meditation actually works. You let go. Okay, anyway, enough about that. It's getting late. So, I'm traumatizing you. Sadhu. 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 Okay, very good. Carry on.